Today, The Guardian's John Harris takes us anywhere but Westminster to look at this unfolding political crisis. And in opinion, Gabby Hinsliff on who Theresa May has decided to reward with honours.
Order.
If you've been watching the news, it looks like a disastrous start for Boris Johnson in Parliament.
The ayes to the right, 328. The noes to the left, 301.
Ayes to the right, 293. The noes to the left, 46.
So the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
There've been six votes, six defeats, forcing him to ask for a Brexit extension if he can't get a deal, and leaving him unable to trigger an early election, which he needs to govern, after losing one Tory to a defection.
Prime Minister, you've lost your majority.
And another 21 to a rebellion. Then, his brother resigned.
Are you completely at odds with your brother, Mr Johnson?
Right. See you, folks.
Followed by the most liberal cabinet minister.
The absence of actually trying to work to get a deal is what has driven 21 of my colleagues to rebel, and I need to join them.
But was this Johnson's plan all along? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, is Boris Johnson's explosive election strategy going to work? John Harris, you're a Guardian columnist and filmmaker, and you've reported on politics from outside Westminster for many years. Yesterday, it was really clear that Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's chief strategist, thinks that journalists don't spend enough time outside London.
What's your next move?
You guys should get out of London. Go and talk to people who are not rich Remainers.
What do you think's going to happen? What's your next move? Will Britain leave the EU on time?
Sure.
And he seems to hold SW1, as some of them inside call it. That's Westminster, that's the establishment. He holds them in total contempt, and he thinks the people out there don't care about proroguing or parliamentary process. How does he think this is all playing out?
I don't profess to be an expert on Dominic Cummings, because I don't sort of spend much time hanging around those sorts of circles. But I've read quite a lot about him, and from what I understand, he is somebody who sort of sells himself to the people who employ him as someone with the common touch. He professes to understand as a matter of instinct the way that non-metropolitan England, chiefly, thinks about politics and life and the big questions that tend to decide referendums and elections. And he's right to the extent that most, or a lot of people, I would say, are sort of tuned out of this great drama that political journalists like you and I are completely fixated on. And we're fixated on it for entirely correct reasons. It is sort of historic stuff, and it does represent a prime minister in a fairly unprecedented way playing fast and loose with the British constitution. It's a terrible thing to see, but people have lives to get on with. And also the way that the language works, I mean, this is sort of how power operates, you know. It's called prorogation. What's that? Right? And, you know, people like me then go up and down the high street, which we'll come to in a minute, and talk to people about this stuff. And we say, oh, he suspended Parliament and so on. But the way that it's talked about is arcane. The visual appearance of it is arcane. I mean, on the night that the bill to outlaw no deal went to the Lords, I had one of the news channels on, and up came this spectacle. We all know what the House of Lords looks like, right?
Manuscript Amendment 2D, Lord True.
It's sort of God's waiting room, you know. And it's very sort of mysterious and weird. And they were filibustering, right?
The system in this country, it does seem to me to be extraordinarily odd to come forward with a motion based on the pretext of prorogation while urgent litigation is pending and where a resolution is expected well in time to, if it goes one way or the other, to enable more time to be given to this legislation.
And I just thought, well, I can't be bothered watching that. It's ridiculous.
Some degree a mild spirit of concern.
I switched on one of the news channels last night, and there was endless talk about John Bercow having thrown in the towel, and they brought in pundits to talk about it.
A sense of MPs standing up one after the other to praise the Speaker. But of course,
he's been this deeply divisive figure, and Brexiteers see him as a Remainer who's setting out to thwart the true Brexit.
I was thinking, who cares about this?
Well, to some people, John Bercow, who apparently is a bit of a hero to people across the seas, was in his element on Monday night.
I had already made the point, people had the manners to listen, which they haven't, that the honour that I will play my part. This is not, however, a normal prorogation. It is not difficult. It is not standard. It's one of the longest for decades. And it represents, not just in the minds of many colleagues, but huge numbers of people outside, an act of executive fiat. And therefore,
the evening ended with them suspending Parliament, as they said they would. And the MPs started chanting, "Shame on you." Is that exactly what Cummings wants, do you think? When we get an election, probably pretty soon, will this sort of scene in the House of Commons with MPs screaming at Johnson play into what we think Dominic Cummings' strategy is of setting up the election as people versus Parliament?
It'll be framed sort of in line with the way that populism, mostly right-wing populism, is working across Europe and in the States and elsewhere, which is that you look at established institutions and so-called mainstream politics and you say, well, this is a problem. These people are the elite and they're trying to frustrate what you want. And I think it will find an audience. How big an audience it will find is another question, because I don't think that people are quite as worked up as perhaps Dominic Cummings thinks, and certainly political journalists think. It's a little bit more nuanced and complicated out there.
I don't know if you're going to take this as a criticism or a compliment.
You can take it.
When I hear you talking about Dominic Cummings, I kind of think about you, John. There's a certain similarity between you because, you know, there's this impression of Dominic Cummings going around the country, doing his own little focus groups in pubs. And we know that right now he is focus grouping all of this in the Midlands. Well, you, John Harris, can out focus group any of them. You've now spent 10 years touring the country for your brilliant Anywhere But Westminster series. And I've seen the list of where you've been. I mean, more than 70 towns across the country, the odd city as well, 140 films. You've been from Dover to Hull to Yeovil, Kirkcaldy, Plymouth, Bridgend, Clonus in Ireland, most recently in the Northwest for a film that's coming out now. How do you think focusing this political situation? Has Downing Street got it right?
I think their message of sort of Parliament versus the people will resonate with quite a lot of people, you know, more than a few million. There is a pretty clearly identifiable group of people out there who are very worked up about Brexit, quite like the idea of no deal, just let's clean break and all those cliches, and kind of feel that, and I understand this, I don't support it, but I understand it, they feel that they asked for something. They were asked, you know, what do you think? And they said, right, we want Brexit. And where is it? Right? It's like a sort of everyday version of what you can say to Alexa when your delivery doesn't arrive. You say, Alexa, where's my stuff? Right? It's a bit like that. A lot of them are men. It's a disproportionately male thing. If you look at the polling figures, and this is my experience as well talking to people, for people who support no deal, the gender balance is quite skewed. It's quite interesting. So maybe it's a sort of, crudely put, it's a sort of stereotype of angry men. They're out there, it resonates with them.
I'm from Staley Bridge originally, and I was chatting to Harry, who's a man who's in his 80s, who I've always thought of as being quite far on the left. I mean, I'm sure he voted for Corbyn in 2017, very politically engaged. And he's just said to me, Boris is going to get it done. He's going to get us out.
Yeah,
do you keep hearing that?
I had exactly that conversation with somebody last week who said, well, you know, not sure quite what's going on here. And their sort of take on it was nuanced and sophisticated. But then they said, well, ultimately, or, you know, when it comes down to it, he's getting it done. It's an effective message. You know, you voted for this thing. Your side won. Where is it?
And over your years out on the road, do you feel that the way voters perceive Parliament and what they expect from MPs is changing?
Yeah, I mean, the cliche is about people's view of Parliament, say, oh, well, it all started with the expenses crisis. And that's true to some degree. But I think there are much deeper forces at work. It used to be the case that political parties were sort of bonded to the electorate by lots of intermediate institutions. So the Labour Party had the mass trade union movement. It was a bridge between the population and sort of high politics. The Tory Party, I was reminded this morning, in 1953, had a membership of 2.8 million, right? Wow. It was a presence in people's lives. Now, notwithstanding Corbyn having 500,000 or 600,000 members, which is quite an achievement, politics doesn't really work like that anymore. Local government has shriveled. It's something very distant. And so I think consequently people feel sort of resentful of it and estranged from it.
You've talked about the people Johnson is targeting who are desperate now for Brexit to be done. And some of them are very, very vocal, including on social media. But so are those on the other side, the Remainers, many of whom feel just as strongly. How does this look to them?
We made a film last week over 3 or 4 days in the northwest of England. And our first port of call was Macclesfield in Cheshire. I'm from about 7 miles from there. It's a former mill town. It's a sort of half gentrified now. Still a sort of hard scrabble working class town in some respects. Not somewhere you'd expect to see a big protest march. And there were 200 or 300 people there on a very wet Monday afternoon. Well, it's a wet Monday afternoon. This is a Tory health seat. The arse end of the summer. And yet people are gathering in Macclesfield in Cheshire.
You said 100 in the film.
That's the fella we interviewed said 100.
All right.
Pragmatic town, and it lets an awful lot go by. So the fact that 100 people have come out is pretty something.
What does it tell you?
What does it tell you? What indeed?
The estimates of the organisers are 300, and I reckon it was about 200, so we'll split the difference. They're all quite understated in Macclesfield, so I think he was playing it down rather. It's a very Mac thing to do, as you would doubtless know yourself. But that's quite remarkable. And there have been protests in Taunton and the Orkney Islands and Bodmin and Shrewsbury and all sorts of places you wouldn't expect there to be demonstrations. So I think that's really interesting. How many of those people there are and the role that they'll play in the next election is a very, very interesting question. I'll tell you one telling thing is I've outside a city, so London, Bristol, Oxford, I've never heard anyone raise the idea of a second referendum unless I prompted them. It's never come up. I think that probably says something.
OK, you've met lots of people who really care about this on both sides of the Brexit divide, but not everyone feels that way, do they?
No, there are a lot of people who are aware of it and who kind of tune in every now and again, but by and large are sort of disconnected from it and feel very confused by it. And incidentally, I'm one of those people. If it was down to me, you know, I only watch this for professional reasons. I don't feel any great emotional or instinctive draw to it. It's tedious and it's slightly terrifying, you know. But there are a lot of people, I think, who feel broadly like that and therefore try and stay out of it. And one of the places recently where we sort of found that feeling was Bury in Greater Manchester. Now, we have a sort of past history with Bury because with John Demokos, with whom I make these films, in 2013... I was at Conservative Party conference 2 years before they won the 2015 election. George Osborne was in his pomp.
We've cut immigration by a third.
We're going to cut immigration.
But what about the long-term unemployed?
Doing the whole hard-working people, workers, not shirkers. We're going to cap benefits, right?
For the first time, all long-term unemployed people who are capable of work will be required to do something in return for their benefits and to help them find work. Others will be made to attend the job centre every working day.
Now, George Osborne, I don't know what's happened to David Cameron, he's back this week, isn't he? But George Osborne, since the referendum, has sort of tried to distance himself from all this. Oh, you know, I don't want any part of this sort of Brexity conservatism. Well, I would argue that the sort of pretty horrible, crabby, you know, let's set ourselves against one part of the population, be it immigrants or welfare claimants or whatever. That sort of politics, which played a central role in the Brexit referendum, was encouraged and accelerated by him. And in the speech, he said,
"Take your arguments to Bury or Morecambe, where young working couples are still living at home with their
If you
parents.
Want to know why this Take message resonates or words to that effect, go to Bury." So we got in the car and drove 8 miles north and went to Bury. And somewhat discomfortingly, we found out it was true.
Everyone was getting money off the government, benefits and stuff, and then they're trying to introduce a new system.
I think we spend too much money on the benefits system.
Yeah, we do spend a lot.
Why should people from other countries come to our country and be able to claim our benefits?
Someone else has got to work for it. You can fuck off and make it yourself.
People were really angry.
People instinctively agreed with this notion that a lot of people who were on benefits, so to speak, were swinging the lead, and that immigration was too high, and that there were things that were wrong with the country which weren't the fault of politicians, they were the fault of their fellow human beings. It was a pretty depressing experience, but it was quite sort of instructive. And lo and behold, you know, 18 months or 2 years later, the Tories won their only majority in the last 20 or 25 years. So it was the right place to go.
And last week, you got in your car.
We are
you
back.
Headed back to Bury.
It's a Sade.
Sade, man. Dying life.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of September. The headlines this morning, Boris Johnson has lost control of the Brexit process after being defeated in the Commons last night. MPs will vote today on delaying Britain's departure.
In 7.1 miles, take exit 80 to merge onto M66 towards Bury.
For a snap general election if they succeed.
We went back to Bury the day after the Commons had passed what Boris Johnson calls the Surrender Bill, the legislation outlawing no-deal Brexit. And we did what we usually do, wandering up and down the high street, talking to people and saying...
Excuse me, we're journalists, we work for The Guardian, the newspaper. It's a very strange way to earn a living. And we're making a film in Bury.
Why would you do that?
Well, we'll explain in due course.
If it's going really badly, we tend to use humour and we say, help me out here, I'm dying, and things like that. We don't wear suits and have a great big camera. We don't start with the politics question. See, I get the sense that when a lot of broadcasters do this, they sort of throw someone against the wall, they got a camera the size of a house, and they go, hello, what do you think of Jeremy Corbyn? And that's going to freak you out. It freaked me out. Are you kidding?
What do you say?
We say, what's it like here? How's Bury doing? And then it'll be three or four questions in before, at least before we say, how do you feel about the political situation? And the sense that I got in Bury this time, which is, it's a familiar feeling in a lot of places, is that people were weary, you know, they were tired.
I want to know how you feel about the future of the country.
Fucking hell, let me sit.
What's this about that Brexit?
Well, maybe.
I really tried to engage with it for a while. I really did. No, I did, and I thought, you know, it's really important. It's very important. This is going to directly affect... With a three-year-old child, this is directly going to affect her. So I've really, really tried to keep up with everything, and now I am so confused that I really don't even know where to begin with it all.
Wow.
I am so confused, and I'm, you know, a bright woman. I can, you know, I'm okay with this sort of stuff, and I am just confused, I think, at this point.
I don't know, it's...
No one knows.
Are you following it?
I was. Not anymore.
It's just overload. It's Brexit overload at the moment, I think.
No one really cares anymore.
About what?
Anything. At all. Really.
What about Brexit?
What about it?
What can we do?
We can't do anything, really.
They've already decided what they're doing, and there's nothing we can
do. Yeah, us personally, we can't do anything.
I can't
18.
Do anything to change Brexit.
Since the referendum, it's all been going off in various ways. Now, if you're a political journalist or a political anorak...
You're also tired,
but you're kind of, wow, look
in
at this.
In a different way.
Yeah, but look at this, it's all going off. He's got rid of 21 Tories. Oh, look, Burko's resigned. Oh, look, there might be an election. When is it? Oh, not till November at the latest, right? Now, life isn't like that for a lot of people, and also politics has ensured that it isn't like that. This idea that we're suddenly in this turbulent phase of British history, I think, is completely misplaced. What's been happening here since 1979? Well, Mrs. Thatcher arrived, upturned society and the economy, completely revolutionised the kind of country Britain was. You know, We had the miners' strike. We had the poll tax riots. What's the next thing? Well, New Labour embraces a great deal of what Mrs. Thatcher stood for. Tony Blair, by 2005, is saying people have to be swift to adapt and slow to complain, open and willing to change. You know, here comes globalisation. That'll hit you. By that time, September the 11th had happened, right? After that, we had the economic crash. Then along comes David Cameron and says, well, I've got my own set of revolutions. I'm going to upturn the health service and the education system, and I'm going to commence a huge programme of austerity, which is going to really screw a lot of you up. Right? Now that's a sort of crass, somewhat moronic telling of the last 40 years of political history. Now along comes the prospect of no deal Brexit. Well, that's like the ultimate sort of disruption and turbulence after all this other disruption and turbulence. And people are knackered. They really are. They're tired. So it wasn't that I sensed that lots and lots of people in Bury were sort of really ready for a fight and I've had enough of it all and where's my Brexit? There was a bit of that. But a lot of people sighed and rolled their eyes and said, I don't know what the hell's going on. I've tuned out. I'm confused. You know, now, if an opinion pollster of an evening phones them, as opinion polling tends to do, and asks them a question, how do you feel about Brexit? They'll give them an answer. But what that doesn't take account of is their strength of feeling. And that's a crucial question in all this.
So we've spoken quite a lot about the Tories and specifically Dominic Cummings' strategy for an election that will probably have sooner rather than later. He's gambling on a lot of variables, but the message is very simple. Targeting Brexiteers, Parliament versus the people. Can we just talk about Labour? Because it's a lot more complicated for them in a way. They've got passionate Remainer members and yet lots of Leave constituencies. Some are really gunning for them to be an all-out Remain party now. But I spoke to one senior figure the other day who posed the idea of Labour MPs being able to campaign either way in a second referendum. Could Labour ever be neutral on Brexit?
It's very difficult. I mean, Corbyn has sort of tried that, hasn't he? I've been to a lot of Labour events in the last 2 years or so where he's sort of made speeches in which he either hasn't at all or has barely mentioned Brexit.
Well, I thank all of the constituencies that are here today. And, of course, the danger is I start mentioning them, I'll leave somebody out, I'll be told off forevermore. But I'm used to that kind of problem with the mainstream media. And I don't care. The one-trick pony Farage is in town today. What does he know about education? What does he know about police cuts? What does he know about the pain of trying to survive on universal credit?
Not talking about
teachers
Brexit.
Going through the pain of trying to work out the B which word teacher they can't afford.
And he's gone on these questions about what kind of society do you want to live in and austerity and all of that. And they can be powerful messages, but it's quite odd, that omission. Because, you know, it's the single biggest issue that Britain has ever faced in peacetime. So to sort of omit it feels peculiar. And I'm not sure they can carry that on, particularly when they've got, you know, I think the idea of a Liberal Democrat, thorough Liberal Democrat revival might be a bit misplaced. But there are other options for people now who feel strongly about Remain, as the European elections proved. So the Labour Party, in that sense, is in a bit of a spot.
And as Labour also gear up for an election, they will also try to represent the so-called people. Is there a decent chance that Corbyn's strategy to win over Remainers but also push the anti-austerity agenda could be a real headache for Johnson?
There is an argument, I suppose, that irrespective of which way Brexit has fallen by then, he's not doing very well. There's something very, for all Dominic Cummings' allegedly Darth Vader-esque genius, you know, there is something fairly shambolic about all this. So, you know, just by dint of Johnson having been Prime Minister for 3 or 4 months, the Labour Party will be in with a better shout at doing well.
It feels as if people saw the Brexit vote as this kind of mega wake-up call that politicians, the media, the establishment, if you like, had not tuned in enough to people's frustrations across the country. Of course, you had, as we know. But do you feel that in 2019, those groups have woken up?
I think to some extent they have. I mean, if you look at the things that reasonably regularly surface now in political coverage and, you know, the sort of comment articles people write and what politicians talk about when they're interviewed. The stereotypical town, what's going on in towns, that's there now in a way that it wasn't 3 or 4 years ago. You know, Boris Johnson's put jump leads on this towns fund, whereby the government is giving a few billion pounds to places that it sees as fitting this description. Incidentally, a great deal of them are marginal constituencies, coincidentally, but that's kind of there. But I'm still not sure whether what we understand politics to be has shifted. I don't think it's just a question of whether people are being listened to. It's what is politics? What matters? What's important? And all this arcane parliamentary drama and John Bercow resigning and who's up and who's down, and I don't think really explains that much anymore. I think we live in a world now in which people lurch in all sorts of different directions and politicians panic and follow them. And therefore, if you want to understand where the story is, you have to begin with where people are at and where they live and all that. And I don't think that's shifted in any way, any meaningful way anyway, either in politics or in the media. And I think that's until that happens, until the first part of the story is where people are, where are people in Wigan and Bury and Glenrothes and Bodmin and Taunton and Ipswich, and then here's the person standing outside number 10. I think it should be the focus of all our attentions because it's where the action is.
John Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was John Harris, who, with John Domikos, makes the brilliant Anywhere But Westminster. The first episode of the new series, in which they head to Macclesfield, Bury and Nuneaton, is out today. Watch it at theguardian.com. Coming up, another controversial resignation honours list. Now, every time a Prime Minister resigns, they get the opportunity to draw up an honours list, which is basically there to reward people for their public service. People can be given peerages and move into the House of Lords. They can be given knighthoods and win titles like Sir, or they can have lower order honours like CBEs. Theresa May has followed in her predecessor's footsteps by doling out a lot of rewards to former advisers. The Guardian's Gabby Hinsliff is not surprised.
Resignation honours lists are never exactly popular things. You know, they don't come out to a great tide of political acclaim. Oh, hurrah, everyone's got honours, let's all be pleased for them. And I think that the idea that resignation honours lists are controversial, that they're packed with favours being returned or people being ennobled who don't really deserve it but happen to be a favourite of the outgoing Prime Minister, I mean, that goes back decades. That goes back to Harold Wilson and the Lavender List, and with Theresa May's resignation honours list, I guess we see that back with a vengeance. For many people, the really shocking thing about this honours list will be seeing Geoffrey Boycott's name on it, and we know that he is Theresa May's hero, that she admired him as a cricketer, she admired his batting style, all the rest of it. But, and it's a big but, you have here a female Prime Minister who had a deserved reputation for being very committed to tackling domestic violence, pushed through a lot of domestic violence legislation, both as Home Secretary and Prime Minister. And here she is rewarding someone who has a conviction for domestic violence. But it's the political side of the honours list, the names that perhaps aren't necessarily household names, but who worked with Theresa May in and around Downing Street, that have become equally controversial. People like Ollie Robbins, her chief Brexit negotiator, gets a knighthood. Gavin Barwell, her former chief of staff, gets a peerage. Robbie Gibb gets a knighthood. And there's also CBEs for Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, the two chiefs of staff. And to many people, those look like rewards for failure, rewards for people who stuck with Theresa May through a difficult time. But that's not quite the same as serving your nation. Robbins has been particularly controversial, of course, but I have to say, of all the list, in some ways, you know, Robbins is one of the more deserving recipients. You have here a civil servant who did his level best to carry out an absolutely impossible mandate given to him under a great deal of hostile briefing from Brexiter MPs. And the idea that he should be rewarded for a job done for the nation probably sits a bit more easily than the idea of Nick Timothy being rewarded for writing a manifesto that lost the Tories the election and then going off to work for the Daily Telegraph, where he has argued for the last 2 years that he was right anyway. every year, you know, every time an honours list comes out, we have the same conversation, which is, isn't it time to ditch this system? It's completely outmoded. You know, it's reeks of patronage. It's shabby. It's cynical. Nobody believes in it anymore. And I think that we'll have that argument this year, like we've had that argument every year. But I think there's a new dimension to it this time, which is that at a time when public faith in the parliamentary process and the democratic process is at an all-time low, when people have no respect for politicians and people engaged in the business of politics, an honours list is really difficult. It's very hard for people to agree on what constitutes public service, who's said to have served the country well, the minute Brexit comes into the debate. I mean, some people will see Ollie Robbins or Gavin Barwell as the people who held out for a more moderate form of Brexit, and that will make them heroes. But to hard Brexiters, it makes them completely the opposite. You know, there is no agreed national sense of what constitutes good public service at a time when the nation fundamentally doesn't agree on its way forward.
That was Gabby Hinsliff. Do read her column. My thanks to John Harris, John Domikos and Gabby Hinsliff. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Elizabeth Cassin and Rosie Gillett. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.